From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! From a marketing point of view, you don't launch a new product in August, so says Andrew Card, President Bush's chief of staff, talking about the new PR campaign to bomb Iraq. Today we'll look at propaganda and the bombing of Iraq. And then, a young man wins a major lawsuit against a school district for harassment by students that he says the school could have prevented. And voters in Miami-Dade County in Florida go to the polls to vote on whether or not to restrict gay rights. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Pro-war hawks in Washington and the British government have seized on a new British report on Iraq's nuclear capability as so-called proof that Saddam Hussein is just months away from launching a nuclear bomb. But there's no proof of this in the International Institute for Security Studies report. The report concluded Iraq's chemical, biological, and ballistic missile programs are far weaker now than they were before the Gulf War in 1991. Meanwhile, Iraq took reporters on a tour of a nuclear site, which it says has concerned U.S. weapons inspectors. The Associated Press reports the buildings at the site south of Baghdad were surrounded by rubble. Inside, bags of mushrooms said to be used in agricultural research were scattered on the floor. Samples of what was described as kidney disease medicine were kept in a laboratory. Iraqi officials say the site was destroyed twice, first by the Israelis in 1981 and then by the Allied forces during the 1991 Gulf War. President-elect Bush held a three-hour meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien in Detroit yesterday. Chrétien said he wants to see more evidence to justify an immediate attack on Iraq. Chrétien said he told Bush UN weapons inspectors should go back to Iraq and that, quote, we have to follow the United Nations. But who needs proof, says War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Donald Rumsfeld rejected calls yesterday for the U.S. to provide further evidence of Iraq's attempts to develop nuclear weapons in order to justify any strikes against Saddam Hussein's regime. Rumsfeld said the U.S. is not seeking to place the Iraqi leader on trial or to punish somebody for doing something wrong. The London Guardian is reporting the leaders of the two Kurdish groups controlling northern Iraq have signed an historic agreement to set aside long-standing rivalries and commit themselves to a democratic federal Iraq. They also pledge to work more closely with other Iraqi opposition groups. The agreement came after heavy pressure from the U.S. Kurds could raise as many as 80,000 fighters and are seen as an essential part of any U.S.-led attack on Baghdad. President-elect Bush also telephoned the president of Turkey, whose air bases could be vital for an attack, the leaders of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, who are opposed to an attack on Iraq, the prime minister of Denmark, which currently holds the European Union presidency, and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. The United Press International is reporting Bush told the world leaders it'll be the responsibility of the international community and not the United States to determine what kind of government should replace Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Meanwhile, French President Jacques Chirac says he's opposed to a preemptive unilateral U.S. strike against Baghdad, but nonetheless yesterday laid out a possible two-step process that could lead to approval by the United Nations Security Council for an attack. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers have started preliminary talks about a resolution that would authorize an attack. And U.S. and British aircraft have attacked Iraq for the third time in a week. The warplanes bombed an air defense command and control facility southeast of Baghdad. The Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv is reporting Israel has given the U.S. permission to stockpile military hardware at Israeli army bases. This according to an official Israeli document obtained by the paper and an anonymous U.S. official. This news from India. 50 people have been confirmed dead after a Calcutta to New Delhi express train carrying 600 passengers and staff derailed and plunged into a river. U.S. embassies in Indonesia and Malaysia closed today after receiving what each embassy called credible and specific threats to security. In the United States, the military has deployed anti-aircraft missiles at the Pentagon and bases around Washington. The Pentagon is claiming the deployment is an exercise to test an emergency defense of the nation's capital. Separately, F-16 fighter jets have begun patrolling the skies over New York and Washington. Close to 150 airport workers in Houston were arrested yesterday at the airport and in their homes on false identification charges. The arrests come as part of a national roundup called Operation Tarmac. In this news from Rhode Island, the Providence Roman Catholic Diocese will pay $13.5 million to close dozens of sex abuse claims against clergy.
Pick up your gun, Johnny, and go to die. You've bought another chapter of the bright and shining light. Texaco Shell and Standard Oil have sent our boys foreign soil. Won't you tell me why do they have to die in Iraq?
Why do I have to die in Iraq? By listener Mark Wendt. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has dramatically escalated its diplomatic efforts and PR campaign, calling for an attack on Iraq. In the last 4 days alone, President Bush has called the leaders of Russia, China, France, Denmark, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, as well as UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Bush met personally with Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and British Prime Minister Tony Blair over the weekend. Bush and Blair claim there's ample evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Blair cited a new report by the International Atomic Energy Agency supposedly showing new construction at a former nuclear weapons site. But Atomic Energy Agency spokesperson Mark Gwazdecki immediately said the agency has been reviewing the commercial satellite photos in question for more than 2 years and that there's no new evidence of Iraqi nuclear activity. He said the New York Times article had gotten it wrong. Now hawks in Washington and London have seized on a new British report on Iraq's nuclear capability as proof that Saddam Hussein is just months away from launching a nuclear bomb. But there's no proof in that report put out by the International Institute for Security Studies. The report also says Iraq's chemical, biological, and ballistic missile programs are far weaker now than they were before the Gulf War in 1991. The New York Times is reporting White House officials are following a meticulously planned strategy to persuade the public, the Congress, and the allies of the need to attack Iraq. The officials are claiming the rollout of the strategy this week was not hastily concocted after some prominent Republicans began to raise doubts. The White House chief of staff, who's coordinating the effort, Andrew Carr Jr., said, "From a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. Today, we're going to have a roundtable discussion about the Bush PR campaign to bomb Iraq. We're going to begin with Lee Hamilton, former congressman of many years. Welcome to Democracy Now!"
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
Well, you served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 34 years. Can you talk about the way the Bush administration is using what it calls intelligence?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not unusual. Information is power in Washington, particularly information in the national security field, which is very much under the control of the president. And presidents will use that information, which they garner through a vast intelligence network, in ways to support their policies. I guess in an ideal world, what you would want is that your policy would be driven by the intelligence information that you collect. The intelligence information would be objective, it would be neutral, it would be factual, and that would be handed to the policy maker. But I think in the real world, what we often find is that the intelligence we get is often tilted or driven by policy rather than the policy being driven by the intelligence. This is not peculiar to the Bush administration. I think all presidents, to some degree, kind of succumb to the temptation to use their almost monopoly power on intelligence in the national security field to reinforce, to buttress their policy.
Congressman Lee Hamilton, former congressmember, former chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, now at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington. Can you talk about disinformation campaign around the Persian Gulf War and how you, as a congressmember, making decisions, dealt with it?
Well, I think what I've just said suggests that you want to weigh intelligence carefully. We have some marvelous people working in the intelligence field. They're very highly professional and capable. It is also true that the leaders of the intelligence community are usually political appointees. Certainly the top ones are. They have a sympathy for the president's point of view. They serve at the president's pleasure in their important jobs, and so they are naturally inclined to want to use the intelligence information they have to buttress the president's policy positions. What that means, I think, for a member of Congress, what it means for the American people, is not that you reject intelligence information. Much of it is right on the mark. But that you weigh it carefully. You look at other sources that might be available to you. You think about it. You make discriminating judgments about it. It puts us all on guard, I think, to be skeptical, to be careful in weighing intelligence information.
We also have Scott Peterson on the line, who is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's based in Moscow and has been doing some reports, disinformation as a weapon in the arsenal of war. Scott Peterson, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about this latest report that is being cited as proof that Saddam Hussein is just months away from launching a nuclear bomb? It's from the International Institute for Security Studies, and the way that Blair and Bush are using the other report from the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Well, I think there's definitely an amount of spin that's going on, certainly in terms of the IISS report, which I've looked at and heard commentary about. And basically, I think for people who are watching this, who've been watching Iraq and who've been basically watching Iraq for many years and saw what the achievements were of the United Nations weapons inspectors in Iraq were and what Saddam's possible capabilities could be in the meantime. You know, he has been operating under sanctions and that sort of thing. It basically what it is it's the IISS report released in London yesterday seems to be one of the best compilations of data yet available or that's been made public, but there actually isn't very much that's new. Even the what sounds like quite a alarming line about the nuclear weapons that Saddam may be within several months of creating a nuclear weapon, there was a very powerful caveat that went with that that the report writers indicated, and that was that he may be able to build such a weapon if he were able to have access from sources abroad that of nuclear fissile material. Now, of course, he's been working to gain that kind of material for years, far longer than when the Gulf War was fought 12 years ago. So he's been working on that. And there was another report that also appeared over the weekend. The New York Times and other news outlets reported it, and that was that that the United States had been actively preventing Iraq from acquiring a very specific type of aluminum tube, which is used in the uranium enrichment process. Now, this indicates two things. One, it indicates that Iraq is still interested in acquiring nuclear weapons, but it also indicates that that if they are still looking for enrichment possibilities, that they're actually, that's a fairly early step in that process. So they've got a long way to go. So the fact that, both President Bush and Prime Minister Blair attached onto that, saying that, you know, this is the evidence we need, and kind of spinning it forward, I think is something that people do need to be wary of.
Let me ask former Congressmember Lee Hamilton about this front page piece in the Financial Times today about Donald Rumsfeld rejecting calls for the U.S. to provide further evidence of Iraq's attempts to develop nuclear weapons in order to justify any strikes against Saddam Hussein and the people of Iraq.
Well, I don't think that's a wise or prudent position. I think what the president faces today is among leaders abroad almost a hostility towards the idea of intervention in Iraq. What he faces, and with a few exceptions to that, of course, what he faces with the American people is perhaps not hostility, but at least doubt and skepticism. And it's not easy to persuade the American people to go to war. So I think there is a heavy burden, really, on the president and his people to come forth with as much evidence as they can to persuade us that Saddam Hussein represents an imminent threat to the safety and security of the American people, to our vital national interests abroad.
Congressman Hamilton, did you vote for the bombing of Iraq in 1991?
No, I did not. I voted against the initial resolution, supported the subsequent funding, of course, for the war, but it was my view at the time that further diplomatic political activity might have held off that war. So I voted against the resolution.
We have John Stauber on the line as well.
I think I'm going to have to leave. I apologize because of other appointments. I'm going to have to drop off your conversation.
Well, then, just before you do, let me ask you a last question about the media and the role it plays. You, as a former Congress member, do you see the media now as providing a fair array of the spectrum of opinion, those who are fiercely opposed to war as well as those who support it?
Well, in general, I'd answer the question yes, but of course the danger is that you rely on one or two sources, and I think what you have to do is look at a broad array of sources. But overall, I think if you put it all together, the information is out there, given to us by the media, for us to make discriminating judgments.
Former Congressmember Lee Hamilton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
He was a congressmember for 34 years, a former head of the House Foreign Relations Committee. As I said, John Stauber is also on the line with us, who looked at the PR industry and how it sold the Gulf War to the United States, the mother of all clients. John Stauber, you talk about how the earlier Bush administration said there was satellite imagery that showed that Iraqi troops were amassing on the border. But it took a smaller paper in Florida to say, no, looking at the satellite imagery, that wasn't the case. Can you explain what happened?
First of all, good morning, Amy. I'm happy to be on the program. I think the Christian Science Monitor article actually does an excellent job of explaining what happened specifically there. And if that journalist is still on the line, I think I'll let him answer that.
But Scott, let me just ask that to Scott, since he's going to be leaving soon. Scott Peterson.
Sure. Well, there were a couple of remarkable cases of spin, or in fact, what appeared to be just outright lies that were provided in the Gulf War at critical moments when it came time for the American people, and also for the American people to decide whether or not they were going to go to war or not. It really did affect the debate. And the example that you're talking about are was an example of satellite photographs that were used in the very early stages after Iraqi forces invaded Kuwait in August of 1990 to help convince the Saudi Arabian government and other people to basically sign up to this war. And what those pictures were purported to show was that there was a powerful Iraqi buildup, not just in Kuwait, but on the southern border of Kuwait, threatening Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, where we were receiving so much of our oil resources at the time. So basically, that threat was leveraged into an eventual very large American military deployment into the Gulf. But basically, what was found out months later was that satellite photographs taken by a Soviet commercial satellite were in fact shown around. In fact, they were shown to and offered to several different news organizations. None of them touched them until a paper in Florida, the St. Petersburg Times, bought these two images and got them looked at by experts and found that lo and behold, there were no Iraq. Not only was there no buildup threatening Saudi Arabia, but there was no trace at all of any Iraqi troops on that southern border. The people that the St. Petersburg Times spoke to were definitely capable of determining that fact. One of them was an imaging analyst who had been a arms control and disarmament agency official during the Reagan administration. Another one was a defense intelligence agency analyst whose specialty was looking at desert warfare. So basically, these two people said how surprised they were that there was absolutely nothing there. That story was published on the 6th of January. The Senate voted to go to war. The U.S. troops and the rest of the alliance were lined up to go, and the bombing began on the 17th of January. So it was too late to make a big impact. But basically, the initial point that helped to push the U.S. deployment really didn't exist.
In fact, it looks like the administration needs the media in making its case for war. As opposed to pushing it away, it embraces it. It first reports what the administration puts out, and then only months later when it doesn't matter. It's almost like the stolen election of 2000. They knew that eventually it would be found out that all the people they'd purged from the rolls were legitimate voters. But all that mattered is that they would not be able to vote on Election Day.
Well, in terms of justifying the war in Iraq, definitely this kind of information came out at critical times. Another element, which I won't go into great detail about, but which a lot of people remember, was the story about the babies being pulled out of incubators in Kuwait from Kuwaiti hospitals when Iraqi soldiers went storming in. Now, of course, you can't come up with a more Hitler-like image than that. It was one that President Bush Sr. Referred to several times. Seven senators spoke about it on the floor of the Senate when they made their, when they were in the debate on whether to go to war or not. It was a very emotive moment that made Americans and their leaders very, very angry. It just so happens to have turned out much later that it was completely not true. That was a made-up story and the tearful Kuwaiti lady who'd made those allegations and said that she'd witnessed it was in fact the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador at the time. No one looked into that story at all and instead let their emotions get in the way, but that is definitely a case of quite serious spin that does affect the debate.
And we'll talk about the PR company responsible for that in a minute. Scott Peterson on the line with us from Moscow, John Stauber with PR Watch in Madison, Wisconsin. And we'll be joined by a British commentator who's been looking at the so-called studies that prove the necessity of bombing Iraq. Stay with us.
Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive or a slave. Would you harbor a Haitian Glorian or Czech, a lesbian?
You are listening to Democracy Now! Later in the program, we're going to talk about a referendum that's being held now in Florida that could strip away anti-discrimination protections of gay men and lesbians. But right now we're talking about the propaganda war that is being waged. As John Stauber says in his book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, how the public relations industry sold the Gulf War to the U.S., the mother of all clients. John Stauber, that story that Scott Peterson was just talking about of the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador never identified as such when she testified before Congress, saying that babies were pulled out of incubators. An Amnesty International report supporting this, that Iraqi soldiers had pulled them out in Kuwait as they invaded. What was the PR firm again that was responsible for this fabrication?
Relations firm, which at the time was the world's largest PR firm and is still one of the world's largest and most influential. Just 6 days after Saddam Hussein's army invaded Kuwait, the royal family of Kuwait, the ruling family, hired the PR firm of Hill & Knowlton and eventually gave that firm more than $10 million. That stunt that Scott described was sort of the icing on the cake, if you will, to make absolutely sure that the Gulf War took place.
In fact, you say in your piece, April Glaspie's meeting with Saddam Hussein that led many to believe, or led Saddam Hussein to believe, the U.S. would not retaliate if it invaded Kuwait. They were also talking about, April Glaspie was talking about doing a little PR herself for a piece that, to make up for a piece that Diane Sawyer did of ABC against Saddam Hussein.
Right. I guess that's one of the many, many ironies here is that many analysts think that Saddam Hussein, who after all was a close ally of the senior Bush administration and the U.S. government, was given an indication, apparently a false indication, but an indication by April, who was the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, that the U.S. would look the other way if Iraq took over the oil fields of Kuwait. And at that time, just before the invasion, the biggest concern of the senior Bush administration was running a PR propaganda campaign to convince the world and the U.S. people that, not that Saddam Hussein was Hitler, but just the opposite, that Saddam Hussein was on our side, the side of the angels.
We're also joined by Kim Samgupta of the London Independent, who's done a piece on the studies that are being used now that have surprisingly, perhaps, not surprisingly, come out over the weekend that say they have the proof that Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons or can get them easily. Kim, can you lay out what these reports are and what, in fact, they say?
There's only one out at the moment, and what it does not do quite clearly, even at the most cursory examination, is provide any proof whatsoever. No, what we have been led to believe is that Mr. Blair will at some stage produce a smoking gun. He will produce a report which is apparently drawing on intelligence sources, proving that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime are a clear and present danger. But there was a huge amount of hype generated by Downing Street about a report which came out yesterday. And this is a report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies, which is a think tank with headquarters in London. And there was a huge amount of expectation on what this will reveal. Well, what it did reveal was nothing much, effectively. What it did say was that in fact the Iraqis are much weaker now militarily, and that includes the weapons of mass destruction than they were in 1991 before the Gulf War. Now, the way it was publicized by the Institute itself was very disingenuous. They said that if the Iraqis received a huge amount of foreign help as well as weapons-grade material, they should be in the position to make some kind of a crude nuclear bomb within months. But even the report stated there is absolutely no evidence that Iraqis are doing this or indeed anyone is offering them that material. But of course, what he did do was that some of the more excitable media over here had headlines saying, you know, Saddam about to launch nuclear bomb within months. So to that extent, the exercise was successful, although I'm glad to say that this morning some of the papers, including ours, have pointed out that if anything, the report says it is to the contrary. The Iraq is in no position at the moment to threaten us with WMD.
I would not say that the U.S. press has the same message today. The reports are being definitely brought out in all the press, saying that there's further evidence that Saddam Hussein has or will get very soon nuclear weapons. Scott Peterson, I know that you have to go in Moscow, but what about this idea that they put forward that we would rather be safe than sorry? Better to bomb him now than, as Condoleezza Rice said, to deal with him after we see the nuclear mushroom?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, that's something that flies in the face of kind of the way that international relations have been handled for decades, in the sense that, you know, a lot of analysts that I've spoken to are concerned that if the United States takes that preemptive step, they are going to be basically handing over a reason that can be used by belligerents in all sorts of national disputes. We're looking at India and Pakistan. We're looking at Israel with a string of its neighbors. You know, we're looking at cases like that, China and Taiwan. I mean, who's to stop India from trying to act unilaterally against Pakistan, possibly starting a much bigger, broader war if the United States itself has taken a preemptive step against a nation that it says is threatening it? So people are concerned about the greater ramifications in that regard. And then regarding Iraq itself, I mean, the question also must be asked that a lot of analysts are asking now is, you know, what truly is the threat to the United States from Iraq? And many people say that there is, or many analysts argue that there is very little threat at the moment, that during the last 10 years that there has not been a single terrorist incident anywhere in the world that has been linked back to Baghdad. And therefore, you know, what they argue is that really Baghdad has kind of kept its hands clean on this front. And even though, no one doubts that Iraq is still pursuing weapons of mass destruction, many also argue that the United Nations weapons inspectors were so effective in ridding Iraq of the vast majority of its hardware and delivery systems that it really is a weak state. In fact, a story that I wrote yesterday that appears in this morning's paper describes an incident in which someone who was a couple of years ago at a military parade in Baghdad, was where Saddam was present, supposedly. It was actually most likely a body double, but he was present watching this huge march pass and looked very smart, and the soldiers apparently wearing white gloves and everything else. And when he got closer, he saw that instead of white gloves, the soldiers were actually wearing white sports socks, just an indication of how weak the regime really is at its root.
And what about that issue of deterrence? What actually would set Saddam Hussein off versus deter any kind of attack?
Well, I mean, many argue that Saddam is deterrable, that the fact that he had all those chemical and biological weapons at his fingertips, along with his entire array of long-range or medium-range ballistic missiles during the Gulf War, and didn't use those, or at least didn't arm those missiles with weapons of mass destruction, chemical or biological ones, when it fired Scud rockets at Israel and Saudi Arabia, indicates that basically Saddam is a calculating player whose chief concern is his survival, knowing that during the Gulf War, if he'd used those weapons of mass destruction, then the United States or Israel or both might have destroyed Baghdad, the regime, and possibly Iraq. He decided not to use those weapons, and people feel, or some analysts feel, that he is still able to be deterred today, and in fact are concerned that if the United States does launch an invasion, that it could yield the very use of those very type of weapons that that the U.S. says it doesn't want ever to see happen.
Scott Peterson, thanks for joining us from Moscow. Kin Samgupta of the London Independent still with us, talking about the rationales that are being used. Your perspective is an interesting one for us, since Blair just came to meet with Bush, shore him up for an attack on Iraq, building the case that it's absolutely essential now to bomb the people of Iraq. Can you talk about Downing Street and the role it's playing?
Well, it's interesting because the Prime Minister appears to be much more gung-ho, much more hawkish than anyone else in the Cabinet. Jeff Hoon, the Defense Secretary, is over in your country now, and he will no doubt make a hawkish speech. I think he made one yesterday, but privately it seems that the war party, if you like, is being driven by the Prime Minister's office, and almost every other of the cabinet ministers have grave doubts about the justification being used. Mr. Blair is at the Trade Union Congress today, where he will describe Saddam Hussein as an outlaw, international outlaw, and say the Iraqi regime is the worst in the world. However, what is happening is, despite all the rhetoric and ratcheting up, opinion poll after opinion poll over here, and I gather it's the same in the U.S. as well, is going the other way. The skepticism about what the government is saying is growing. And the problem that he faces now is that he has said that he will produce this dossier, which would be comprehensive and will intrinsically prove the threat, and that has been delayed time and again. Now, to a certain extent, the Prime Minister has become a hostage to that, and now there's a huge amount of expectation on what this dossier will prove. It was meant to be published weeks ago. It's been delayed repeatedly. It was meant to come out this week, but we're told by the Prime Minister's official spokesman yesterday that that's not going to happen.
What about the idea that Tony Blair's pollsters seeking to explain Blair's sagging popularity are now saying in a secret Downing Street survey that George Bush is his main problem, that his biggest ally in the world does not sell well in Britain?
Well, there is a conception here that that Blair is slavishly following what... administration says, and that is having a detrimental effect. There was a huge amount of empathy and sympathy, you know, for the U.S. After September 11th, and that has continued. And there was broad-based support for the operations in Afghanistan, but Iraq is seen as something quite different, and is seen by a vast array, and it cuts across party political lines as you know, something which is being tagged onto the war on terror without really any of us seeing any evidence as to why that should be.
We're going to try to get the spokesperson for the latest report that just came out on the line. So I hope you stay with us, Kin Samgupta, for just a minute. But I wanted to go to John Stauber for a minute, who has continually chronicled the PR company's power in issues from the selling of bioengineered foods to war. Can you tell us, John Stauber, about, we just heard about Hill & Knowlton and its use during the Persian Gulf War of selling the war to the American people, but talk about some other PR companies and their role.
Well, I'll be happy to. And first of all, Amy, let me say that 12 years ago, during the first war in the Gulf, the Internet didn't exist. And there wasn't the public access to the sort of information we have today. And one of the real tools we have for promoting peace and stopping war is the Internet, so that now at prwatch.org, our website, we're able to report every day on propaganda, and people can search our website under Iraq or under Rendon Group or under Hill & Knowlton, and learn a history that's been kept from us. This horrible scam that was perpetrated as a business enterprise by Hill & Knowlton that sold the first Gulf War is still unknown to most Americans. Not only did the media flub the coverage of that war and fall for all the pro-war propaganda, but even a year later, after John MacArthur revealed that the testimony of Naira, the baby-killing testimony, was all a complete farce, that was never investigated. No one went to jail for that. And we see that even firms like Hill & Knowlton are involved today. We have a report up on our website, our Spin of the Day feature, in August 26, titled Pentagon Calls in the Flax. And this story actually appeared in the PR trade press, PR Week, and it describes how people like Victoria Clark, who used to run Hill & Knowlton's Washington office, Sheila Tate, the D.C. lobbyist who has also been on the board of Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and others are in close communication with the Pentagon, sort of an unofficial advisory group helping Don Rumsfeld developed the propaganda campaign for the war. We've seen how Burson Marsteller and other PR firms have been hired by Saudi Arabia to try to massage their image with the American public. And with all due respect to people like Lee Hamilton, I think we need to learn from what happened 12 years ago. This isn't about rational arguments. This isn't about proof. This is about propaganda. And what the administration is doing is it's searching for the most hot-button way to get the U.S. public behind this war. It has little or nothing to do with actual evidence and rational debate and everything to do with whipping up a frenzy of emotion to attack Iraq.
John Stauber of PR Watch, prwatch.com. Well, we'd hoped to get the spokesperson for this latest study that has come out, but the while we were directed to a number, no one is picking up that number right now. Kin Sengupta, how do you tease out, as a reporter, as a columnist, the PR from the facts?
Well, in this case, it was pretty easy, frankly, for most of us, because all one had to do was look at the report. And it was quite obvious that, in his own language, that the report was not what it was purporting to be, and certainly wasn't what Downing Street was promoting it to be. So in this case, it's not too difficult. I think the difficulties we shall face is if and when they produce evidence which is intelligence-based, because, of course, we would not have access to them. We would not really know the veracity of the intelligence being supplied. Having said that, some of us have got contacts in the intelligence services over here, and these are straight, honest people. And hopefully, if we are being misled, if the government is dissembling, the intelligence services, for their own interest, really, may well say, "No, hang on, this is not what we say."
And John Stauber, Andrew Card, the chief of staff of George Bush, former auto industry lobbyist, comment that the reason that they let things get a little out of hand in August with Republicans stepping out of line and raising questions is because you don't launch a new product in August, and they waited to launch the PR campaign now, which will be launched on September 11th, a most solemn day when President Bush goes to Ellis Island and amps up the PR campaign and then goes to the United Nations on September 12th?
Well, I think it shows the cockiness and also the brutal honesty of some people in the administration, you know, being willing to admit that this is just a huge sell job. And unfortunately, what they're doing here is the worst sort of exploitation of the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I was listening to a radio interview the other day with a representative of the Cato Institute. And, you know, they're a libertarian organization heavily funded by industry on most health and safety issues. They're really on the wrong side of the tracks. But they're, on this issue, they were very calmly explaining that the absolute worst thing to do if we're serious about stopping terrorism would be to attack Iraq, because that's like pouring gasoline on a fire. I mean, that's a right-wing analysis. The thing that George Bush has going with him in the face of such dissent, even on the right, is the war on terrorism. And what he's banking on, unfortunately, is that by exploiting the horrible events of 9/11, he can build up enough support emotionally among the American people to give him a green light to do whatever the hell he wants to do. And that, I think, is what's really scary. And that's why it's very important that people dissect the way that played out 12 years ago. I mean, 12 years ago, there were the Hill & Knowlton firm, through the Republican pollster, the Worthling Group, were doing daily surveys and focus group work to try to come up with themes that resonated. You might remember George Bush Sr., the first thing he said is, this is a war for oil. That fell flat. The American people weren't willing to die or pay money for a war for oil or to redeem a corrupt, brutal government like the Kuwait regime. So through focus groups, they found what resonated was demonizing Saddam Hussein and casting him as another Hitler with weapons of destruction that threaten the U.S. That card is still in their hand, but now what they've got is they've got the horrible events of September 11th. And I think what the Bush administration feels is that when it's time to attack Iraq, they can play that terrorist card, that patriotism card, to the hilt. And that is just the worst sort of exploitation of what happened on September 11th a year ago.
Well, John Stauber of PR Watch and Ken Sengupta of the London Independent, I want to thank you for being with us. By the way, folks, if you'd like to get a video or audio cassette of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. And we'd like to know what your plans are for September 11th. Democracy Now! Joining forces with WBAI's morning show Wake Up Call will be doing a four-hour program tomorrow on September 11th, bringing you reports from Ground Zero of a whole array of different voices, family members who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center, who have a different message than the answer is war. Their overall statement, our grief is not a cry for war. Tune in to that program tomorrow, 7 Eastern Standard Time. Stations around the country will be broadcasting it, and we're part of a 13-hour Pacifica nationwide program called Patriots for Peace and Global Justice, and that will be airing on stations around the country, brought to you by all of the Pacifica stations as well as affiliates. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to go to Miami-Dade County in Florida to look at battleground, really, right now, over the possibility of repealing anti-discrimination laws that protect gay men and lesbians. Stay with us.
Which radio entertainers have to contend? Now, the BBC once wrote to me and said, "Dear Norman Long, we thought you'd like to face the mic with your piano, smile and song. So will you bring your repertoire along for us to see, to go over it with a pencil of the blue variety?" So I looked my list of songs up, to the studio I flew. I said, "Here's a nice song called Violets." They said, "Oh, that's much too blue." I said, "Is Robin Adair all right?" They said, "Robin Adair, my head. Just think of the bald-headed men you'll upset. We can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up, determined to show my skill. I started warbling merrily that well-known song until I sang, "No rose in all the world, no rose," they cried, "my hat. Why, you'll upset all the fishmongers. We can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up, because I was beginning to tire. I said, "Well, here's a good one, a song called Strike the Lyre." They said, strike the lyre, what on earth do you think you're at? With thousands of barristers listening in, we can't let you broadcast that. So I looked my list of songs up, found one of...
BBC censorship here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today in Miami-Dade County in Florida, voters will decide whether to repeal anti-discrimination laws that are already on the books. The vote comes a quarter of a century after one of the world's most famous gay rights battles, which also took place in Miami. In 1977, the pop singer and promoter of the state's orange juice, Anita Bryant, led an anti-gay rights crusade called Save Our Children. Her slogan was, homosexuals cannot reproduce, so they must recruit. Her campaign led to the overthrow of a local ordinance in Miami-Dade County that forbade discrimination on the grounds of sexuality. It wasn't until 1998, 20 years later, that an anti-discrimination measure was reintroduced in the county. Now the same battle is being refought. A group called Take Back Miami-Dade is trying to repeal the measure again. The group is backed by the Christian Coalition and other religious groups. The Take Back campaign has been working hard to get out the Latino and Black church-going vote. Over the weekend, Take Back Miami-Dade claimed that election officials were under orders from the mayor to falsify the results. Miami-Dade will be voting on whether or not to repeal gay rights legislation just days after three gay men were attacked in the gay stronghold of West Hollywood in California. One of the men, Trev Brody, is currently in a coma. We're joined right now by Hedy Pena, co-chair of the No to Discrimination Save Dade campaign in Florida. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So today is the vote?
Yes, that is correct. Today is the vote. It's the day we've been waiting on and working on for almost a year now. And I don't know if your listeners know, but like you mentioned, in 1998 is when the words sexual orientation were added into our county's anti-discrimination law. And soon afterwards, the Take Back Miami group announced that they would collect signatures to overturn it, or to put this on the ballot in order to overturn it. And they failed, but the second time they collected enough signatures, although there is currently an investigation by the state attorney's office, and they have found fraud, and there were four arrests made, including the head of the Christian Coalition group here in Miami.
What do you mean, the head of the Christian Coalition group?
The chairperson. Yeah, the leader of the Miami chapter of the Christian Coalition, Mr. Anthony Verdugo. So those arrests occurred in August. However, that does not mean that does not have an impact on the vote. The vote still takes place because it was happened. Those are two separate things. Those criminal charges are separate from the vote. So we are still voting on this today.
And the resolution or the law that they want to take off the books, what exactly does it say?
Well, it's the county's anti-discrimination law, which protects residents of the county in the areas of housing, employment, finance and credit, and public accommodations. Public accommodations meaning like hotels and restaurants, and finance and credit like if you apply for a mortgage. The categories that are currently under this law are race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, sex, pregnancy, age, disability, marital status, familial status, and sexual orientation. So today's vote is whether to remove the words sexual orientation from the county's anti-discrimination law.
Well, talking about discrimination, we're going to turn now to Nevada. A school district has agreed to pay $450,000 to a gay student named Derek Henkel for failing to stop anti-gay harassment. Derek Henkel was a victim of violence, bullying, and physical attacks at three different high schools in the Washoe County School District. The agreement is the first legal settlement to recognize the constitutional right of gay and lesbian students to be out at school and protected from harassment. What has the Washoe County School District agreed to do in your case, Derek?
Good morning. Well, thanks so much for having me on, first of all. The Washoe County School District is taking actually now a leadership role, which we're very glad for, in this movement. And they have agreed, as part of the settlement agreement that we've entered into with them, to 18 school policy changes to make sure that what happened to me, the daily attacks and daily nightmare that I faced on their campus simply as a result of being gay and being out of the closet, to make sure that that doesn't happen to any other kids. And it's particularly important to me because they're the first school district to recognize a precedent-setting ruling that the federal court made in my case, which says that gay kids have the right to be out of the closet in public schools, and that the answer to gay kids being harassed on campuses is not for gay kids to hide and live in fear, but that they have the right to be out and open and that their administrators have a responsibility to protect them.
Can you talk about why you brought it against the school as opposed to against the kids, why the kids weren't disciplined?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the kids were never disciplined by the school, and we felt that it's the school's responsibility to make sure that they're creating a safe environment for their students. I think that high school, for me, was definitely a time of great self-exploration and learning, as it was for all of my peers. And I think that all of my peers, have gone through some sort of process around, dealing with people who are different than them, whether it be for whatever reason and purpose. And what we're talking about is not changing beliefs or behavior around sexuality or sexual orientation. What we are really talking about is creating safe schools for kids. So we wanted to make sure that we held my administrators accountable for not educating me. As well, my case was the first case in the nation to hold an individual school teacher personally accountable in her individual capacity. And what we're saying there is that teachers are the front line of this problem. So when they create climates in their classrooms where that's so gay is acceptable to be said, and there is an escalation to, kids being called fags and homos in the classroom, they're going to be held accountable by our community for not educating our youth.
Can you talk about what exactly did happen to you?
Yeah, there were three large incidents of harassment, the largest of which was when I was coming back from lunch and was attacked by a group of six students in the middle of my school parking lot. And this was the first school that I was at. This incident was only weeks after coming out of the closet on my campuses. And this group of six students surrounded me in the parking lot of my school. They took out a lasso and said, "Let's string up the fag and tie him to the back of our truck and drag him down Mount Rose Highway," which is the highway that ran in front of my school. And they got the lasso around my neck three times, and I was trying to get away from the kids. And had they been any better at lassoing, I don't think that I'd be here today. And it was tremendously hard. I remember the survival instinct that took over when my life was being threatened at my high school, and I knew that if I ran, that I would be forced to the ground and that that would probably be it for me. So I was walking as quickly as I could. I was scared to death of running, and I could see one door that I was trying to get to, and I was altering my path through cars in the parking lot. I was trying to lose these kids that I had broken free from. And I got into what should have been the safety of the school building, and I called my administration, and it took them an hour and 45 minutes to respond to me. And when they responded to me after an hour and 45 minutes, I was still so hysterical from being attacked at my school that I said they tried to throw a neck around my rope and was not speaking correctly. I was, really hysterical. I couldn't form sentences. And the administration laughed at me and made a joke with the substitute teacher who I had forced to lock the door to the classroom because I was so afraid that the students were going to come in and continue the attack.
Well, Derek, we've come to the end of the program, but again, the important story now is that this is unprecedented. The Nevada School District has agreed to pay $450,000 to Derek for failing to stop anti-gay harassment.
Yeah,
that
I
does
think
it for
what
the
we're saying,
Derek. We're out of time. I'm sorry to say, but we will come back to this case. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.